You're listening to a podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Hard Talk with me, Stephen Sacker. Thanks for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. My guest today is a doyen of the German political establishment with the least German of names. David McAllister owes that to his father, a Scot who met and married a German woman while living in West Berlin. He is a lawyer by training but chose to enter politics as a moderate conservative member of Angela Merkel's party, the Christian Democrats. His rise was fast. As Premier of Lower Saxony in 2010, he was widely tipped as a future German Chancellor. However, he was voted out of office in 2013 and is now a member of the European Parliament and chair of the Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. In that capacity, he still has a close relationship with Chancellor Merkel and an influential voice on many of the challenges facing Germany and the EU. How far to push integration, how to deal with an American president out of sync with Europe's worldview, and how to manage the exit of Britain from the European club. Thanks to its extraordinarily robust economy and stable politics, Germany is indisputably Europe's most powerful nation. But what does Berlin want to do with its power and influence? Well, David McAllister joins me on the line from the European Parliament in Brussels now. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thank you.
Let's start with the notion that the European Union has been wrestling with something of an existential crisis for the last few years. Do you think the EU has now emerged from that crisis, or is it still in the middle of it?
Well, the last years weren't easy for the European Union, that's obvious. But I think Brexit and other incidents were a wake-up call for the 27 member states. And I believe that the European Union is now facing towards a better future. And you can also see in the recent polls that the approval rates for the European Union membership is going up in the 27 member states.
A strong Europe, though, it needs a strong Germany. And right now, of course, it's short term, but right now there isn't even a real German government and no clarity about what that governing coalition is going to look like. That's a problem, isn't it?
Yes, but this happens after elections. The German voters decided about the composition of the new German parliament in September, and now we're busy forming a new government. It will probably be a four-party government with the CDU, the CSU, the Liberals and the Greens. And hopefully the coalition negotiations will be concluded before Christmas. I hope that we then will have a strong and stable government in Berlin.
Well, it won't be as strong and stable as people anticipated. I mean, that's clearly the result of an election where the CDU, your party, suffered a real reverse. I mean, the result took the CDU-CSU vote down from 8 points, I believe, to 33% from over 40 before. The number of seats is down. And, of course, you've got the fact that breathing down the necks of the mainstream parties is a far-right group, the AfD, who got 12% of the vote. Suddenly, Mrs. Merkel's leadership in Germany, her dominance of Germany, doesn't look like it looked just a few months ago.
Well, of course, my political parties, the CDU and CSU, were hoping for a better result in September, but the German electorate decided to give us just a little more than 32%. But we have shown responsibility since then. We are ready to form a government again. Our coalition partner, the Socialists, dropped out of the coalition a few minutes after the polling stations had closed. I don't think that was a very wise move. So the only option we have to form a government now is to try this so-called Jamaica coalition with the Liberals and the Greens, which will be challenging. But for us as CDU, one thing is clear, we will not cooperate with the far right in the German Bundestag and the far left in the German Bundestag. So this is the only option we have. And I was sad to see the Alternative für Deutschland become the third strongest party in the German Bundestag. We have to accept this vote, but we will also make very sure that the German Bundestag will not be a platform for racism and extreme nationalism.
Right, but would you accept the point made not least by Pascal Lamy just a few weeks ago that what we have now is an Angela Merkel who has emerged from that entire electoral process politically weakened and the anti-European forces in Germany have gained? Put that all together and your opening remarks about your belief that, you know, Europe can now move forward, that optimism is going to be hamstrung by a much weaker sense of Merkel's and German leadership.
Well, I don't agree with Pascal Lamy. Angela Merkel was re-elected for the fourth time as chief of a national government. I don't think you will find many similar cases in the Western world. We all knew that this election campaign would be very challenging. And I'm very sure that we will have a stable government before Christmas. And I would also like to point out that despite the 13% the Alternative für Deutschland got at the elections, this means that 85% and more Germans voted in favour of pro-European parties. So there is a strong pro-European consensus within the German political system. And beyond the coalition of CDU, CSU, Greens, Liberals, also the Social Democrats are interested in bringing the European Union forward. And Germany will continue to play an active role in this European Union, as we have done the last decades.
Yeah, but I mean, but that sort of boilerplate rhetoric. But let's get down to specifics. You've got a French president now, Emmanuel Macron, who's laid out a vision of what he calls the historic reconstruction of Europe and the Eurozone. You know, he's talking about very ambitious things, a finance ministry, the ability to impose EU-wide taxes, debt sharing within the European Union. Now, these are all things that are highly controversial in Germany, but more particularly are rejected by the Free Democrats, who are now going to be an instrumental part of the governing coalition, as you've just laid out. So I come back to this point. Germany cannot show the leadership alongside Macron that many pro-Europeans were hoping for.
We've heard two very important speeches on the future of Europe in the last few weeks. So one is the speech of President Macron. The other one was Jean-Claude Juncker's State of the Union speech. And I've had a very close look at both speeches. And I would say that 80, 85, perhaps 90%, we have common ground. And if you look at the German-French cooperation, which has always been the driving force in the European Union, I am very confident that there are a lot of political issues where Paris and Berlin can cooperate very closely when it comes to the future of Europe. Closer cooperation on defence and security, strengthening the European external borders, strengthening a European border and coast guard, closer cooperation on the fight against terrorism. And also we agree that if we want to keep our joint currency, the euro, sustainable, we will have to strengthen the economic and monetary union. And I'm ready to discuss many French proposals. And I would also say that we have a lot of things in common. Where I am of a different opinion than President Macron is, I don't think it's wise to create new institutions. That means a eurozone government and a eurozone parliament. We should use the existing institutions we have. These are the Commission, this is the European Parliament.
Yeah, but
and
hang
we are
on a minute.
Also ready.
Hang on a minute.
Yes.
If you're not prepared to buy Macron's point about what I think, you know, the experts call variable geometry, and that is the deeper integration in the Eurozone, then as usual, the EU can only travel at the pace of its slowest members. And if we see all of the scepticism now from Eastern Europe, from Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, essentially, if you're not prepared to expect the multi-tier, multi-speed Europe of Macron, then you're not going to get anything changed at all.
I don't like using the term multi-speed Europe, but I would prefer to talk about different levels of integration. And the heads of government of the EU27 made this clear at their meeting in Rome that this is the way to go. Certain member states want to deepen the European integration, and they should be able to do so when it comes to defence and security, when it comes to cooperation within the Schengen area, but also within the Eurozone area. What I was trying to point out is Jean-Claude Juncker was right in his State of the Union speech when he said the euro isn't only the currency of the Eurozone, the euro is the currency of the whole European Union, apart from the United Kingdom, which is leaving, and Denmark. So I would prefer to use existing European institutions instead of creating new ones like a Eurozone Parliament. And as a German, I also see the necessity that we have to develop the rescue mechanism for the euro into a European monetary fund. But one point is very clear, and that is not only a point from the German Liberals, but also from my party: we won't accept the mutualization of debts. So I see a lot of common ground with President Macron, and I'm very sure that French visions can be combined with German pragmatism to keep the European engine going.
All right, but just briefly on that one point, you just said very clearly, we will not accept the mutualization of debt. That is a red line, is it? Because that
means that there is going to be a very severe brake on the deep economic, monetary and fiscal integration that Juncker and indeed Macron envisage. The Germans are going to be a brake on that, it's clear.
Well, this was a clear message in the election manifesto of CDU and CSU for the Bundestag's election in Germany. And it was also a similar position coming from the Liberal Party. So I don't like talking about red lines, but I think this is a clear German position which our partners in the Eurozone will have to accept.
Let's talk about other fissures. I want to get on to Brexit in a minute. Before we get to Brexit, do you think that we're not sufficiently aware of the degree to which there is a new set of fragmentations inside the European Union, which are dividing the old Western European members from the newer members in the east of the Union? I'm thinking of the so-called Visegrad countries, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic. You can add a few more. They are very unhappy with much of what they hear coming from the centralised institutions in Brussels. And I think they are beginning to feel that they are being frozen out of the decision-making process.
Well, a European Union with 28 member states, or in future with 27 member states without the United Kingdom, is a complicated organisation, undoubtedly. But if you look at the history of the European Union, with six member states, with nine, with 12, with 15, it's always been challenging. And Europe always lives from the willingness in the member states to find compromises. Yes, there are some different views on migration between the West and the eastern part of Europe. But
well,
I
hang
think
on,
we
it's not just on. It's easy
out.
To say it's just about migration. It's also about you and I mean, not you personally, but the Brussels institutions telling the Poles that, in terms of their treatment of the judiciary and their own constitution, they're behaving outside the parameters of European values.
Well, the European Union is more than the single market. The European Union is a community of values. And our joint values are democracy, the rule of law, and other important values. And if one country is in danger of violating these fundamental principles, it is not only fair, it's also an obligation of the Commission to investigate this thoroughly. And this is exactly what the Commission is doing according to our joint treaties.
How would you characterise the state of Brexit negotiations?
Well, I still believe that Brexit is a historic mistake, but I have to accept the decision of the British people and the UK government. We're in the middle of the negotiations. We all knew this wouldn't be easy. We've all entered uncharted territory. The clock is ticking. We will have to conclude the negotiations on a technical level at the end of October 2018. So this gives us now 11 months not only to settle the British withdrawal, but also the cornerstones of the future relationship. Hopefully, at the European Council in December, the heads of government will agree that sufficient progress has been made so we can start the second phase of the negotiations.
Well, you say hopefully. I mean, do you think that is going to come to pass? Do you think the British government has a coherent strategy for a start?
Well, at the last European Council, the heads of government stated that sufficient progress hadn't been made, but they also showed their readiness to prepare for a decision to be taken in December. But it now depends what the UK government will deliver. I think the speech of the Prime Minister in Florence was important in setting the tone. The Prime Minister made clear that the UK will honour all its financial obligations. What we now need is to translate this promise into a concrete and firm commitment to actually settle all the financial obligations. And if we can do this within the next weeks, and Michel Barnier and David Davis and their teams are working on this, then I'm quite positive that we can actually see this sufficient progress being achieved.
Yeah, but they're miles apart. I mean, in that Florence speech, Theresa May claimed that she was making a major effort at reaching out by saying, you know, we'll pay our budget obligations right through to 2021, which amounts to 20 billion euros the UK government is quote-unquote giving to Brussels as financial settlement, but the message from Brussels is it's got to be around 60 billion. So you tell me, how do you bridge this gap?
What we expect from the UK is to settle all its financial obligations with regard to the EU budget, to other European bodies and funds, and also to other EU-related facilities and investment programmes. And once we have seen a firm commitment of the UK government to settle these obligations, then it makes sense to actually calculate the concrete amount, what the British withdrawal will cost. That's the way we should go ahead, instead of discussing facts and figures which in the moment nobody can really acknowledge.
Well, I suppose in the end it comes down to trust and clarity on both sides. Here's something that Manfred Weber, a colleague of yours, senior Conservative German MEP, said the other day. He said, there's a big question about who the EU shall call in London on Brexit. He says, who speaks for the British government? Is it Theresa May, Boris Johnson, David Davis? And he went on specifically about Boris Johnson, saying, reading Johnson's attacks against his own prime minister's position, he talks of quarrels, political contradictions, and he ended up by saying, please sack Johnson, because then we might get some clear answers as to who is responsible for the British position. Do you share those feelings?
We will accept the UK government as it is composed. Theresa May is the Prime Minister. She's in charge of the UK government.
But the point Manfred Weber's getting to is, do you, honestly, I mean, you know, you're a significant figure at the European Parliament. You are watching this closely. Do you honestly believe that Theresa May is truly in charge right now?
She is the Prime Minister, and as long as she is the Prime Minister, she will be treated as a Prime Minister, and I haven't read any news that she won't be the Prime Minister. So I will accept the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister, and also David Davis, who is doing, from the British point of view, a good job negotiating this British withdrawal with Michel Barnier. Let me once again underline, we in Europe didn't ask for this divorce. It's a British decision to leave the European Union. We want to make the best out of the situation. Brexit will never be a win-win situation. Brexit won't be a win-lose or lose-win situation. Brexit will be a lose-lose situation for both sides. But let's try and make the best out of this divorce, which we didn't ask for.
All right, some quick fire points, if I may, before we finish. There's a lot to get through. Catalonia, you as chair of the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee have been watching that very closely. Simple question for you. If the Catalans, in their regional election slated for December 21st, of course called by the Madrid government, if they clearly vote by a majority for pro-independence parties, will you and other senior figures at the EU at that point recognise their right to self-determination?
This is an internal Spanish conflict. We have the rule of law in Spain. We have a strong constitution, and what the separatists in Barcelona are doing is unconstitutional. It is not possible under the Spanish constitution to leave the state of Spain.
But you're not a tone-deaf politician, Mr. McAllister. You've actually won elections in Germany. You know how politics works. How do you think it's going to look if the people of Catalonia go to the polls, frankly, forced there by a Madrid government decision to call these elections, and if they vote clearly for pro-independence parties, you're saying that vote will have no legitimacy and the EU won't even bother acknowledging it?
This is an internal Spanish conflict, and it will have to be solved within the Spanish framework. That's why I don't understand there are calls for a negotiation role of the European Union, because neither the separatist government in Barcelona nor the central government in Madrid have asked the EU to negotiate a dialogue. This will have to be sorted out. And I'm pretty sure that if you have real elections in Catalonia, the silent majority of those Catalans who are fed up with the separatist movement will have a possibility
to actually declare their will.
Because the referendum which took place was illegal.
But that's an entirely different case. I grant you, we'll find out on December 21st what they vote for. My question is posited on the notion that they might, who knows, they might vote by a clear majority for pro-independence parties. And I want to know what the EU will do then. And you seem to me to be saying, we'll hold our hands to our ears, we'll be deaf to the rights of the Catalans to self-determination, and we will continue to support a government which, last time there was a vote, sent in the military police to drag people from the polling booths. How do you think that looks?
The referendum was unconstitutional and illegal. I know what you're trying to get at, but why should I answer a hypothetical question? All member states of the European Union, including the European Commission, have been very clear that they didn't accept the declared independence of the separatist government in Barcelona.
Before we finish, I would like to talk to you about transatlantic ties as well. Donald Trump clearly doesn't think much of the European Union, and in particular, he doesn't seem to think much of Angela Merkel and Germany. He's described the trade policy of Germany as bad, very bad. He says he's considering putting new tariffs and controls on German exports of motor cars into the United States. How would you describe the German feeling about Donald Trump?
The United States and Canada are our most important partners outside Europe. We are democracies, we are market economies, we are strong trade partners, and we closely cooperate on security and defence. And that's why I strongly believe, as a huge majority of Germans, including the federal government, that strong transatlantic relations are key. Yes, there are some new challenges for our transatlantic relations, for German-American relations, since President Trump was elected. But I must say, in the last months, even though President Trump is seen quite critical in my home country, the German government, as the EU Commission, is working with the US government on a number of issues.
I can't let you get away with that.
Common interests.
I mean, you seem to be ignoring reality. The German government, along with other EU governments, pleaded with the Americans not to abandon the Paris Climate Change Accord. Donald Trump didn't listen. In recent weeks and months, you've pleaded with him not to end the certification of the Iran nuclear deal. He didn't listen to you on that item either. How can you convince me that Europe has any leverage with the Trump administration today?
Well, just before you interrupted me, I was about to say that apart from a lot of common issues we do have some different views. Not only Germany has criticised the Trump administration for abandoning the Climate Protection Agreement of Paris. We also see very critical American moves to end the nuclear deal with Iran. We negotiated 12 years to get this deal done. It was hard work. And I was in Washington last year with other members from the Foreign Affairs Committee and the European Parliament telling our US counterparts that the Americans should always take into account the possible consequences if this deal...
To be honest, Mr. McAllister, I guess the basic problem... I guess that, if
yes.
I may, we're almost out of time, but the basic problem is Donald Trump's administration doesn't appear to believe that Europe counts for much. Yes?
Well, I strongly believe that the European Union will survive and it will be even stronger because I strongly believe that in the 21st century, in a globalised world, all European countries are stronger and better off together. And only together we will get the eye level with the United States, with China, with India and with Russia.
We have to end there. But David McAllister, I thank you very much for joining me on Hard Talk.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was an edition of Hard Talk presented by me, Stephen Sacker. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.